I think I was so engrossed in what Stanley was saying.
Not Stanley.
I mean,
Harold.
Harold.
We're back on track, are we?
Let's see. We talked about the two older ones.
Yes, and the third son was born in November 22nd, 1946, and the daughter on June 6, 1949.
We'll return to more about your children and their lives later on. We want now to turn to your early years with your family in this city. Where did you live in the early years of your marriage?
Well, we started out in an apartment on Baum Boulevard near Morwood Street.
But you were here in Pittsburgh.
Pittsburgh, yes. Because I got involved with John Lewis and Philip Murray in the Mine Workers Union and was active with them right from 1934 on through my graduation in 35. And then when I graduated from Pitt, I spent a year with the Pennsylvania Security League, which was a wing of an arm of the Pennsylvania Federation of Labor, organizing WPA workers.
But so you were mainly based here in Pittsburgh?
All the time out of Pittsburgh.
What was the community like in those years, culturally, politically?
Here in Pittsburgh? Mm-hmm. Terrific. We had Pittsburgh, we had the Nixon Theater. I used to usher there occasionally in order to get in for free. Sometimes I'd get in without ushering and also for free.
It was pretty wonderful theater.
And then we had another theater that's where the Alcoa building is now. What was the name of that one? I saw George M. Cohan there.
The Aldine?
George M. Cohan, the song and dance man, did the cakewalk. And there was music too. We used to go to the symphony. We had symphony in 35, 36, 37, 38. I think we had symphony then. Yeah, our symphony was revived, yeah. We used to have concert artists come.
Politically, do you have any particular recollections of the city at that time?
Oh, sure, because I was very active in the Democratic politics at that time. Right from day one, because all the workers and everybody associated with the Steel Workers Union before, that's the old Amalgamated Association, Iron Steel Workers, Tin Workers, and the Rank and File Group, that's before the Steel Workers Union was organized by Lewis in 36, they were all Democrats. Many of them were ex-Republicans, but they were all Democrats.
In your home in those years, so was religion a factor?
Yes, I'd say yes. Yeah, my father, when he died, he wanted us to say yahrzeit for him every day, and so we went to Beth Shalom in the morning and in the afternoon, my younger brother and I.
I meant to ask at the time when you said your father was responsible for starting a synagogue and so on, and yet,
yeah.
An Orthodox, but you were never bar mitzvah.
No, because we left there and went to Nemeco in Pennsylvania when I was at the bar mitzvah year and never ever quite got around to it.
I see.
Never got around to it.
What about your boys? Were they?
Oh, sure, yeah. Our three boys, yeah, and our daughter was confirmed. She didn't get a bar mitzvah. She didn't want it.
I see.
The boys were all bar mitzvah, yeah.
Were there any special family activities in those early years? Camping, hobbies, vacations, family projects, whatever?
Oh, the biggest project was to go down to Penn Station and beg, borrow, or steal a ticket to go to New York over a weekend and come back again.
With your children?
When I was going to school.
Oh, yes. I'm talking about...
With the children?
With the children, yes. Did you...
Oh, well, when we had children, why, we were fairly well off by that time. We did, I mean, with our children, oh yeah, we did lots of things. We went all over the place. We weren't overnight outdoor campers, though.
I see. Do you have any special hobbies or family projects that you were involved with?
Hmm... No, we just played pitch and catch with the kids.
I see. Did the Depression have any significant effect for you prior to your marriage and after your marriage?
Well, we knew it was there and so on, but I was fortunate enough to just get by it. It never adversely affected myself or my two brothers in any significant extent. We were able to carry right on with our academic studies and go right out into jobs. So we were not penalized by the Depression. So
what about the war years?
Well, the war years, I was in the assistant director of the Steel Division of the War Production Board in Washington, and we lived in Silver Spring, Maryland, which is part of Washington, D.C.
So you were draft deferred then?
Pardon?
You were deferred from service, I guess.
Yes, well, they wanted to put me in the Army as a major, but then they reassigned me to the War Production Board, and we figured out, Phil Murray did, that you're better off not to take the majorship because you're then under Army discipline, and this way you were free of Army discipline. Mm-hmm. So I turned that down. And they wanted to make a major out of it so they'd have control over me because, as an agent of the Union in the War Production Board, I did things that was quite embarrassing to the steel companies.
Did the Roosevelt era have a significant influence on you?
Oh, sure.
Your philosophy?
Sure. We thought Roosevelt was great stuff until some years later when we found out what he really was. But he was, as a social innovator, he was very influential. Jewish people were very fortunate that he died when he did die, because there had never been a state of Israel if he had lived.
I see. You really feel that very
strongly. It's not a matter of feeling, it's a matter of established factual history of fact.
I see.
He would never have stood for it. He was an Arabist.
Now we turn to your professional and business career. It's been so extensive, Mr. Rutenberg, I have listed some of your involvements for us to discuss here, hopefully in some kind of chronological order. But if there are any significant omissions as I go along, please fill in the gaps. Can we start with 1933, when you were still in college?
Yes.
I researched your activities, and I learned that you worked on a publication called Economics of the Iron and Steel Industry back in 1933.
That's right. That was under the professors. There were three professors from Pitt. One had labor, one had marketing, the other had production. And I worked for Daugherty, who had labor. And that's how I got to know the rank and file steel workers in the different mills, and who had organized into Blue Eagle Lodges under the Blue Eagle of the NIRA. National Industrial Recovery Act that Roosevelt passed in 1933.
You worked under these professors' supervision?
Under this one professor,
yes.
I got $15 a week. That was National Youth Administration. $15 a week and 25 cents for lunch. I mean, for apple pie, a hamburger, and a glass of milk. Why, $15 was a lot of money. Tokens on the streetcar were 3 for a quarter, and we lived on Beeler Street, and I didn't use the car as much. It was just a 10-minute walk to the cathedral. Mm-hmm. So I didn't waste money on streetcars.
Well, that was quite an assignment for a young college student.
Yeah.
This particular publication was followed.
You bear in mind in that connection that with, I had the psychology of the steel workers. I lived with coal miners in very formative years of my life. So while I spoke English only at the time, I spoke English at the university level, and I spoke English at the workers' level. And I could talk to them with the same psychology that they had. I could communicate. I could use the words that meant the same thing to them as I intended that they should mean, which was an enormous advantage as I watched others who didn't have that background.
You spoke their language.
I spoke their language and their words and their feelings, sure. because we were intimately associated with our customers in Nemacolin, Pennsylvania. Half those miners were customers of our store. We had the biggest store there, and it was on, and so I got to know them very well, and I went to I went to fourth, fifth, sixth, seventh, eighth grade in a coal mining town, coal mining children.
It was really a very significant influence.
That's right. There were some white collar workers, engineers, and supervisors, and metallurgists who were not metallurgists, geologists, who worked for the coal company, whose children went to the public school also. But in the main, they didn't. They were sent away to private school, and my father got that idea from them doing it. But he says, "Good enough for the going, might that would be better for the hood."
Following this one publication that you worked on in the early years, you also did have publications in The Nation, The New Republic, Survey Graphic, Harvard Business Review.
Yeah.
How did you have entree to this kind of prodigious publication at such an early age?
I was writing about subjects that were of interest to the editors. I mean, you submitted a paper to an editor, and if it hits his fancy, if it meets his policy, and it's something he wants to publish, he will.
You were still in college?
Oh, sure. Well, I earned money writing while I was in college. I did work for the Pittsburgh Press.
The Pittsburgh Press is one thing, but the Harvard Business Review is something else.
Well, the Harvard Business Review articles, they came after after the Steelworkers Organizing Committee was organized in June of 1936. And so I was out of college by then.
I see. It's still very impressive,
yeah.
I have to add. I understand what directed you to the labor field because of your background, but was any particular person an influence?
Well, certainly as Dr. Daugherty was, in the extent that he gave me this job that exposed me to the steelworkers. And then I became the secretary of the rank and file committee, took control of the union in 1934. We went down to the White House, threatened a steel strike, had all kinds of publicity, met the top people. But everybody but Roosevelt himself. Roosevelt had a secretary by the name of Howe, and met him, and I met Senator Wagner, and Fanny Perkins, the Secretary of Labor, and Harry Hopkins was a close to Roosevelt then. And John Lewis come over to us and urged us not to, he sent an emissary, John Brophy, not to strike, he says, because I'm going to organize the steel industry, said John Lewis, but if you fellas strike, you're liable to kill the opportunity for a generation, because he says you can't win. So we listened to him. However, the textile workers were also threatening a strike then, and they did not listen. They went on strike, and they never did get organized for 20 years.
Was Philip Murray in the picture of this time?
Sure he was. He was vice president of the Mine Workers Union, and but the man that interfaced with us in 1934 was not Murray, it was John Brophy, who was a right-hand man of John Lewis. I'd met Murray in that time, but he wasn't engaged with us in detail.
And see, in 34 you were an investigator for the U.S. Senate Munitions Committee.
Yeah, that was it was a job I had in the summertime. 1934, I was investigator. Stephen Rauschenbusch, that I mentioned as being the man that later became top official in the Department of Interior, he was secretary and chief investigator for the United States Senate Munitions Committee that was headed by Senator Gerald Nye from out in the West, and Champ Clark from Missouri, and Vandenberg from Michigan. And and then while I was investigating munitions sales by a company down in Lawrenceville in the summer of 34, who were selling arms to both sides in the revolution in Cuba, why I ran across a file that showed the sale of guns and tear gas to Weirton Steel Company and a couple other steel companies at the same time. So I just took that file out and copied it. Well, it was pre-photocopy machines, but you could go to a blueprint shop and you could make blueprints of it, black and white, white on black, or black on white. And Senator Guffey, he raised holy murder that it was outside the jurisdiction of the Munitions Committee, and Senator Nye had to placate him and saying, well, this is just a young investigator, he didn't know, and so on. But that information was then made available through Heber Blankenhorn, who was a newspaper man by profession, who was a colonel in the First War and a general in the Second World War, and he was in charge of propaganda. He got that information out to the New York Times and Baltimore Sun. Baltimore Sun was a big influential paper in those days. Washington Post was hardly anything, but New York Times and Baltimore Sun were, both of them were. And so that had to do with labor, because I had already been working on the already been with the rank and file committee. It was a Memorial Day, 1934, we threatened a steel strike in the White House. Got a lot of publicity.
It's a pretty unusual experience for a college fellow, I'd say.
Yeah.
I wasn't quite clear what you said about the investigation of the munitions. Ammunition.
They
had a sheet which said they were selling it to the company. Is this what you?
The Munitions Committee. They were engaged they were anti-war people. Senator Nye was, and he was against America entering the war when it did. And Sham Clark, and they passed a bill that made it illegal for the United States to provide any arms to the Spanish government. Because it was a legitimate government in Spain, that Franco was the rebel, and they had an embargo on funds. That came out of the Senate Munitions Committee work, but they were anti-war people. And the whole thrust of their work was to expose the trade in arms, to prohibit it.
I note that you were also a labor member of the Industry Committee of the Wages and Hours Division, the U.S. Department.
Yeah, well, as the chief economist for the Steelworkers Union, then I was on all kinds of committees at the Labor Department, Commerce Department.
From 36 to 46, I list here different positions that you held. You were research director of U.S. Steelworkers of America.
That's right.
Yeah. You were involved with the War Production Board in Washington for a couple of years.
Yes.
And you were director of the Pittsburgh Housing Association.
Well, just on the board, I guess.
Oh, I see. Yes. I see.
I wasn't a paid official. I was just on the board, probably.
I see. We did talk about a couple of these previously, except the Housing Association. You say you were just on the board there.
Yeah, I guess if it's listed, yeah. I didn't recall it too clearly, but I know my association would have been just as a member of the board, and I was a member of the board also of the Child Service Organization. Did we have the Federation then, or we had a something like it back in those days? We were active in the union, of course, raising money for community funds. While I was the chief economist and research director of the Steelworkers Union, I was also assistant director of organization for the Northeastern region, so that I had a top administrative leadership job, not elected, but appointed. So I was more than just a staff person. I negotiated union contracts and conducted strikes, et cetera.
In connection with the War Production Board, you lived in Washington at that period.
Yeah, we had to move down to Washington. I always had an office in the CIO headquarters in Washington, D.C., and, of course, in Pittsburgh. But when during the war, we moved to Washington with the two boys. We lived there a couple of years, but I would always spend a lot of time in Washington, but just staying in hotels.
Mrs. Rutenberg, in her book Kitty, referred to your dollar-a-year status.
That's right.
That usually refers to top-notch experts, I think.
Yeah, well, I was just barely under the line. I was getting $5,600 a year.
I see.
And just barely anything less than that, or you couldn't be a dollar-a-year man. But there, I was able to. So the union could continue to pay my salary and expenses.
Well,
you have enough. Better. You have 15 minutes.
Oh, fine. I believe sometime after 46, you switched from a labor advocate to the management side.
That's right. I left the union in 1946. Those reasons are discussed in my book, Self-Developing America. And we advocated a policy for the union. We, myself, and one of the vice presidents, Clint Golden and Joe Scanlon, that you had to collaborate with management in order to provide benefits, because if you didn't, why, you'd milk the cow dry. And the union decided against adopting our cooperative policy, which we pursued during the war with great success. And so we lost out, and I left.
I predicted
that they would ruin the steel industry in 15, 20 years. Well, it took 35 years, but they did. They helped ruin it. Other factors played its role too, but they drove the first nail in the coffin.
So this was the basic reason for your
switching
to the management.
That's
side.
Right. I went on to executive vice president of Portsmouth Steel Corporation, where I put in union managing cooperation. We had great success there for a couple of years, but I never got any support from the union, from the top union, but I did from the local union.
I see. That was from roughly 46 to 49.
That's right.
When you were with Portsmouth Steel.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
How did you find the first assignment in management?
Just walked right with it. I mean, I always
see.
Had a lot of self-confidence that I'm sure went back to my mother and to Massanutten.
You lived in Ohio then in those years?
We did. We left Pittsburgh for just a couple of years. We lived in Portsmouth, Ohio, when I was executive vice president of Portsmouth Steel Corporation. That must have been our third son was born in November of 1946, and Kitty didn't come down until January of 47, and we left there in January of 49. So we were there 2 years.
What was their product?
It's a basic steel mill. They had blast furnaces, coke ovens, open hearth furnaces, and made steel. It was a basic, fully integrated steel plant.
And you say you did work out a cooperative arrangement with the union?
Oh, yes.
There.
Yeah, we did. We had quite a program there.
Is
and
it still in existence?
No. That plant's long since gone belly up.
Despite the fact that you demonstrated that it was workable and productive, it didn't spread.
Well, it sort of got that whole policy got changed when I left.
I see.
And I left there on a matter of principle again. Cyrus Eaton controlled the company. Cyrus Stephen Eaton. And he was a bit of an industrialist and financier. He was sort of the Boone Pickens of his time. And it was a public company, and he had a son and a son-in-law who wanted to take advantage of the public shareholders, and I wouldn't be a party to it, so I had to leave. They bought me out.
I see.
Didn't take much for me to know the difference between right and wrong. So then I went out on my own. Thereafter, I never worked for anybody. After that, I was always in business for myself, although I did work for a little while with Colonel Rockwell. But there is an independent contractor, not as an employee.
In what years were you affiliated with Colonel Rockwell? that later?
Well, I was affiliated with Colonel Rockwell on a personal, informal basis from 1937 until the day he died. He died at age 90. He was born in 1887, so he must have died in 1977. And in the years 19, we went around the world in 1960, beginning in December of 1961, December of 60. I then went on, worked with the colonel as a full-paid consultant, and worked with him until I bought the United Steel and Wire Company in April of 1964.
I was as
a consultant and a brain truster for him. But it was just formalized my relationship that had gone back to 1937.
I see.
And then I worked closely with him in the War Production Board. He was in charge of production at the Maritime Commission. I was in the War Production Board, and the Maritime Commission was always fighting for allocations of steel plate to build ships, and I worked closely with the colonel through those years.
Well, following the Portsmouth Steel, I believe from 49 to 51, you were president of Parkett Corporation of Pittsburgh?
That's right.
What was their product?
Well, that was just a personal investment company. Har is Harold, Kid is Kitty, Harkett.
Oh,
I was a personal investment company.
I see.
And I was looking for an opportunity of a company to buy and build up on my own, which I finally did do in 1951 when I took over control of the Keystone Driller Company and made water well drilling machines that we sold all over the world.
So that Harker Corporation
was a personal
only
holding
existed
company.
For a couple of years.
That's right. And for tax reasons, we did liquidate it a few years later.
I see.
Never recreated it, never had need to. It was a personal holding company.
From 51 to 59, you were president and chairman of the board of Star Drill Keystone
That's
Company
right.
Beaver Falls.
Yeah, I bought the Keystone Driller Company, and then I merged three other companies into it. And in the process, changed the name to Star Drill Keystone.
I see.
We sold water well drilling machines all over the world. Kitty and I traveled in over 50 countries. Selling these water well drilling machines. Drinking water, irrigation water.
Did you introduce them in some fairly backward areas?
Well, backward in Spain. We ran across a Keystone drilling machine that had been purchased at the turn of the century. And we just modernized their fleet there. Mm-hmm. And sold a lot of machines.
So you traveled extensively in this assignment.
That's right. We got to see the world without joining the Navy.
That was a pretty good deal, I'd say.
Oh, very good.
Why did this terminate?
Technology in 19... I started them... When I took over the company, they were making cable tool machines, which is the way they drilled water wells back at the time of the pyramids. Well, they used the hemp rope then. They didn't have wire rope. But the same principle, chop, 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 and then I supervised a group of engineers who built a rotary machine to drill water wells, and that machine sold for $50,000-$60,000, and we got so much contingent liability that it became top heavy, and I had to sell the company to a larger firm that could carry that kind of financing. I sold it to a big shovel company, Coring, K-O-E-H-R-I-N-G, in Milwaukee.
You said something about supervising engineers. You yourself have no engineering background.
No engineering background, but I'm a practical engineer. Mm-hmm. I've done a lot of engineering work and still do to this very day.
I see. At some point following Star Drill, you became involved with Humanation Associates, around 59. Is that still in existence?
No, not really. We published our jobs book then. 22 years ago, 1964, How to Create and Save Jobs in the Pittsburgh Area. And the book is just as current today, only more so than it was then. but neither the union nor the steel companies would pay any attention to it, so we gave up on it after a few years.
What was its aim then, just as you say?
Well, the aim was to develop union management cooperation so that the union wouldn't drive a nail in the coffin of the steel companies. Because the union had such a combined political and economic power that they could extract more benefits from the companies than the companies could pass on to their customers. And that would only lead to bankruptcy, which it has done. But it is not the only nail. The other nail was management for short-term profits helped build steel plants all over the world. That was nail number two. And nail number three then, of course, was the open market for steel, which gave the international competition. The companies here couldn't compete, still can't compete, except behind an iron fence, a terrible wall.
That went out of existence then when?
What?
The Human Nation.
Well, it's just a personal undertaking of my own. It didn't, you know. We went on to Israel and practiced union management.